Hi. Dave Emery here. This is, for the record, program number 861, Greek Tragedy, Part 3. This is being recorded on September 6th of the year 2015. This is Labor Day weekend, and we're going to once again focus on the sorry state of Greece's economy, and we're going to ruminate a little bit about that, and we're going to take a look at events in Greece's past, in particular its World War II history, and then we're going to, in, I guess you could say, observation of Labor Day, we are going to extrapolate to a certain extent from the Greek situation to things not only in the U.S., but elsewhere as well. And one of the things that we're going to be looking at or contemplating is slavery, past, present, and future. Does slavery have a future? Well, that is among the things that we are going to be taking a look at. We're going to begin by jumping back into the archives to April of 1984. And what we're going to do is to listen to part of a recitation of part of Greece's World War II history. We're going to be listening to part of AFA program number one, looking back from 1984, The Hidden History of the Cold War, part one. Again, this was recorded in April of 1984. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nick Tuck, who was absolutely invaluable in assisting me with the on-air responsibilities for the old archive shows. And we're going to listen to something that most people don't know about, and that is what happened during the closing stage of World War II in Greece. Greece had largely been liberated from the occupying Axis forces by a very fierce guerrilla movement, much of which was centered around the ELAS group, that's E-L-A-S, who were doctrinaire Marxists. However, even before the guns fell silent in Europe, the British and the Western Allies basically betrayed their Greek combatant allies and stabbed them in the back in such a way as it basically led to a long, bloody civil war, which helped to set the stage for the corruption which has helped to bedevil Greece in the years since World War II. The issue of Greece, of the money that Germany owes Greece in World War II, is one of the things that has cropped up in connection with the Greek tragedy. So we're going to listen to a little bit about what happened in Greece during World War II, and then we're going to come back to the present.
Right. Now, basically, in both Greece and Yugoslavia, you had two Balkans countries. You had the same sort of pattern holding. Now, you had fierce partisan movements, which, in other words, guerrilla warfare units, which, for all intents and purposes, routed the Axis forces in both countries. And in both countries, you had what were called anti-fascist coalitions, which were both centered around the communist partisans, but embodied sort of a mixed bag of groups, most of them left of center politically, but in general, they were all opposed to fascism.
Now, in most cases, these groups were centered around the communists or the socialist, Marxist, whatever you want to call them, groups, not because of the fact that they were centered on that ideology, but because of the fact that the communist groups, in most cases, were the only structured resistance to fascism. And we see this now in Central and South America. In El Salvador, the left has, the opposition has coalesced around the leftist groups, not because everybody opposed to the El Salvadoran military juntas has been a Marxist by any means, but because these were the only people who were actively opposing them and the only people that have the structure put together to carry on opposition.
And another point to make, I think, in that same context is that ideology, developing what Nip Tuck said a little further, ideology really was not the key here. They were were not the communist partisans and the center, sort of the linchpin of the anti-fascist coalitions, both in Greece and in Yugoslavia, were the partisans, the communist partisans. That they won popularity not because people adhered to a Marxist ideology, but because, as Niptuck said, they were the only organized resistance. And indeed, it was the very tight organizational discipline of the communists which won over the population, specifically the various domestic fascist groups and the Italian and German fascist occupiers routinely plundered all of the population groups in both Yugoslavia and Greece and the other nations. Whenever a German or Italian column or else some of the domestic fascist groups either in Germany or either in Greece or in Yugoslavia would go through an area, they would frequently massacre the population and always take what few possessions they had left. In other words, they'd take all of their stock animals, their food, any jewelry, anything that was of any real value. In particular, foodstuffs and clothing were taken from them, so that starvation and economic privation in general were a way of life, not just because of the harsh conditions imposed by the occupation, but also because the fascist elements routinely plundered the population. And in both Greece and in Yugoslavia, what I guess the main selling point for many population groups initially opposed to the partisans, the left coalition, was the fact that the partisans would not plunder when they would go into an area. So that rather, as we saw perhaps on the other side of the spectrum with Herbert Hoover, the prime mover here, the main motivational factor, is not ideology, but rather the sort of physical stuff, the goodies. Basically, Hoover had $1 billion in 1912 dollars. In Russia, he didn't want to lose that, and the main reason why the communist-led, and I say communist-led partisan bands, the anti-fascist coalitions in Greece and Yugoslavia prevailed, was simply because they treated the population right. They knew, people knew that when the partisans were in control of an area, they got to keep their goats and their milk and everything else, and indeed, partisans were meted out extremely harsh punishment to anybody who broke discipline. In other words, a partisan who took a cup of milk or a goat from one of the population was summarily executed. And this was the single greatest selling point. So that the ideological factor here is perhaps for our purposes today almost a stumbling block in terms of our understanding, that it was the way they treated the population and specifically their military resistance to fascism and the lack of looting which won over the populations in these two areas. Okay, now in Greece, in both Yugoslavia and Greece, the left of the anti-fascist coalitions led by the communist partisans kicked out the fascists. In other words, they militarily defeated the fascists. Now, the Red Army moved into Yugoslavia, and so basically Tito and his communist partisans remained there, although they very quickly established an independent attack from Stalin, who was irritated with Tito because Stalin wanted Tito to conform to his wishes and to cooperate with the Western allies who wanted a piece of Yugoslavia. Tito, who along with his partisan organization had basically endured pure hell in order to free Yugoslavia from Nazi occupation, there were many brutal campaigns of extermination. They were not about to give up what they had won, and so they simply, this was the start of the break of Yugoslavia from the Soviet bloc, because Stalin was thinking in terms of through great power diplomacy, and Tito simply wanted to retain the independence they'd won through force of arms. Now, in Greece, the British landed, and because the British were opposed to communism, they immediately undertook to remove the Greek partisans who, just like the Yugoslavian partisans, had militarily defeated the fascists. Now, when the British, quote, retook Greece, unquote, from the Nazis, they lost a grand total of 3 soldiers because the Greek partisans had been so effective in reducing the Nazi resistance in Greece. I'd like to read you now from a book called The Kapitanios. Well, actually, we're going to take up now some information from a book called The Kapitanios. Now, The Kapitanios is the story of the Greek partisan movement. It's authored by a man named Dominique Udesh, last name E-U-D-E-S. It was copyrighted in 1972. 2 by the Monthly Review Press, a softcover edition. Now, the story of what happened in Greece after the British landed, and keep in mind, the Axis powers have been driven out, is related by Dominic Udesh in The Kapitanios. That's spelled, by the way, Kapetanios.
All right. Now, bear in mind, we're talking about several different groups here that the British found themselves in contact with. The security battalions, or sometimes called the security forces, were in fact the local fascist groups that had been had taken power during the time of World War II and under fascist domination. The groups, yes.
Yeah, they were very similar to the Vichy French. In other words, these were the Greek collaborators. The security battalions were the domestic fascist militia here.
All right. Now, at the time that the British came in, of course, owing to a series of agreements that had been made, the British were to, in fact, disarm these fascist groups and to offer no resistance to democratic movements within the countries that they were supposedly liberating and to allow them to start to form their own governments again, et cetera, et cetera, and in fact, mostly in to disarm and disenfranchise these various fascist groups. Now, reading from the Kapitanios by Dominique Udish, it says, "The promised purge," meaning the purge of the fascists, "had not yet taken place. It was not due to happen for a long, long time. It was written into the Caserta agreement that, quote, the security battalions," those self-same fascists, "will be regarded as enemy organizations and will be treated accordingly, except where they give themselves up on the orders of the military command of Allied forces in Greece." For the time being, they were left pretty much alone in the capital. Scobie's orders to Spiliotopoulos, military commander of the Athens region, had been extremely indulgent toward them. Quote, "When the Germans withdraw or surrender, you will instruct the battalions to desert to their homes and hide, or to surrender to our forces." Scobie had no hesitation in nursing the former pro-German militia with an eye to recruiting them for the coming civil war. The security battalions which surrendered to the British were regrouped in the Peloponnese and Chalcidice, where they were not only not disarmed, but trained by British instructors in the handling of modern weapons. As the Feldgrau, or Field Grey, tide ebbed away to the north, meaning the Germans, the British were preoccupied with preventing a resurgence of ELAS, E-L-A-S, activity, that is, the partisans, communist-led, non-anti-fascist partisan group. The British were preoccupied with preventing a resurgence of ELAS activity, and no operations on any large scale were mounted to transform the precipitate withdrawal of the Reich's soldiers into a fully fledged rout. Hampe noted during the retreat that his column was frequently flown over, but never attacked by British aircraft. On the road, it met various EDES units accompanied by British officers. Everyone would continue about their business with a courteous salute. It was more like a relief than a pursuit.
All right, very quickly, a couple of names there. Scobie was the British military commander in Greece. Hampe was the outgoing German military commander. ELAS, E-L-A-S, was the army, the actual military wing of the anti-fascist coalition in Greece. And another name you're going to hear here in just a second, EAM, was the National Liberation Front, or the political component of the anti-fascist coalition. Okay, now, take note of the reference in that passage from the Kapitanios that Niptuck just read, which talked about the coming civil war, because the British, from the moment they landed in Greece, were determined to oust the communist partisans, the anti-fascist coalition which had taken power there, and remember that they were allied with this anti-fascist coalition. Nonetheless, that did not stop them from planning and eventually undertaking open military operations against the partisans in direct violation of the Tehran Agreement between Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill, which forbade any troops retaking a country from fascism to use those troops for any purpose other than combating fascists. And yet, in spite of that agreement, listen to the following paragraph from a dispatch from Prime Minister Winston Churchill to Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden at this time. I believe it was Anthony Eden, Foreign Secretary. Anyway, to the Foreign Secretary. In my opinion, having paid the price we have to Russia for freedom of action in Greece, we should not hesitate to use British troops to support the Royal Hellenic Government under Mr. Papandreou. Andreas Papandreou, or rather George Papandreou, was the social democrat who the British had selected in order to, as the head of state in Greece, in order to further their own anti-communist aims there. His son, Andreas, is currently president of Greece, by the way. Continuing here with this memo from Churchill to the Foreign Secretary. This implies that British troops should definitely intervene to check acts of lawlessness. Note, acts of lawlessness. We're going to examine the definition of that in a second. Surely Mr. Papandreou can close down EAM newspapers if they call a newspaper strike. I hope the Greek brigade will soon arrive and will not hesitate to shoot when necessary. Why is only one Indian brigade of the Indian Division being sent in? We need another 8,000 or 10,000 foot soldiers to hold the capital and Salonika for the present government. Later on, we must consider extending the Greek authority. I fully expect a clash with EAM, and we must not shrink from it, provided the ground is well chosen. 3 weeks after the liberation of Athens, EAM, which had suffered 3 years of furious combat and enjoyed the support of the great majority of the Greek nation, note that phrase, was suddenly the declared enemy of Churchill's Greece. In writing, quote, I fully expect a clash with EAM, unquote, he was not speculating but giving expression to a wish, a settled objective which was to be the outcome of 3 years of systematic manipulation. So keep in mind that in this dispatch, Churchill basically is, basically declaring war for all intents and purposes on a movement which had, as noted there, the overwhelming popular support of the majority, the solid majority of the Greek population. And still later, Yudesh notes of Churchill and his November 7th directive to the Foreign Secretary. Churchill had been trying to engineer a collision since the 7th of November, but Elas was still hoping to win the political battle by showing its teeth. Scobie issued more proclamations. On December 2nd, aircraft showered the capital, that is Athens, with leaflets, quote, I am going to protect you and your government against any attempt at a coup d'etat and against unconstitutional acts of violence. The Communist Party and EAM retaliated by calling a general strike for the next day. Athenians were asked to demonstrate in the streets on Sunday, the 3rd of December. And this demonstration here, of course, is the popular demonstration to oblige the British to abide by their treaty to remove the fascists from power in Greece. Recall in the passage Nip Tuck read, the security battalions, the fascist militia, were not only kept in power, but were being salted away for a future civil war.
Being trained by the British and not disarmed in the least. All right, talking about the day of that demonstration, and reading once more from the Kapitanios by Dominique Yudesh, it says, the first procession from the suburbs marched into the square behind an immense banner of the Red Lion of Kaisariani, with all his claws out. Long live Kaisariani, cradle of partisans and revolutionaries. Another, further back. When tyranny threatens, the people must choose between chains and arms. Many demonstrators carried a shorter slogan, the Germans are back. The procession arrived in a solid mass at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. A youth surged from the front ranks and, encouraged by the yells of the crowd, began a wild dance. He leapt high in the air once, twice. Suddenly, he doubled up and fell to the ground, his chest covered with blood. An automatic weapon was barking somewhere. It was a machine gun, spitting death from the roof of police headquarters on Constitution Square. Each burst chopped into a densely packed crowd, and few bullets were wasted. Another had opened up from the roof of the royal palace. For several minutes, each one an eternity, the firing continued. The crowd tried to climb over the railings into the royal gardens. People flattened themselves behind the low wall surrounding the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. Some were trying to hide behind a big hoarding wrenched from the railings. It carried a photograph of Roosevelt, underneath, underlined by the words, "Welcome to our great liberators." The square continued to fill up as the machine guns rattled. From the distant suburbs, from Phaleros, Kokinia, Kaisariani, Pankrati, the unsuspecting sea of humanity flowed forward. hearing nothing but its own murmur. Horrified journalists witnessed the massacre from the windows of the Hotel Great Britain. It lasted 2 or 3 minutes. 28 were killed and more than 100 injured. It is quite unthinkable that machine gun nests could have been set up on the roofs of public buildings in the heart of Athens without the authorities getting wind of it. British troops, wrote Leeper, had been standing by in the neighborhood of Constitution Square in case the situation got out of hand, but they were not needed, unquote. Leeper is, of course, an historian who wrote When Greek Meets Greek in 1950. Whatever the specific contribution made to this incident by the authorities, whether it was by virtue of direct responsibility or through more or less deliberate negligence, it is quite clear that the government's refusal to purge extreme right-wing groups had led to a situation which made some kind of confrontation absolutely inevitable. The collision anticipated by Churchill in his 7th of November dispatch to Eden had been engineered in the most monstrous manner.
Now, a thing that's worth noting is that eventually these sorts of provocations in which the fascists in Greece were allowed to go about armed, in essence, to retain their arms, this inevitably led to a state of de facto warfare between the ELAS, the Anti-Fascist Liberation Army of Greece, the partisan movement, and with the fascists who were left in Greece. Now, the ELAS began military actions against the Greek fascists. They pointedly refrained, at least initially, from attacking the British because the British were their allies, and they knew that if they fired on the British, then the British would undertake full-scale military operations against them. So they simply confined their military actions to opposing the Greek fascists. However, this did not stop the British from becoming involved and evaluate whether or not the British, how conscious the British support for the fascists may have been. In other words, whether or not allowing the fascists to set up machine guns on the roof was an accident, or whether it might have been a deliberate achievement of British policy, as you listen to the following.
And especially also in light of what we heard earlier about Winston Churchill's determination that there was going to be a collision. Okay, in the Philopappou district near the Theseion, the Grivas organization was defending the building it had occupied since the liberation.
Interrupting, the Grivas organization, also called the X organization, G-R-I-V-A-S, that is a reactionary general, sort of a domestic Greek fascist who, with his organization, had served as sort of the strong arm men, the secret police, the muscle men, the goons, for a series of reactionary regimes in Greece, even before the Nazis, but they were then co-opted by the Nazis and put to work by them.
These people specialized in hunting Democrats, and had done so with some success under every regime. They were unanimously loathed by the Athenian population. The assailants swept towards the building, attacking with terrible violence. They were suddenly stopped in their tracks by the appearance of British tanks. Firing on the British was formally forbidden, and the firing ceased immediately. Grivas's men emerged from cover, clambered onto the tanks, and were almost all driven away, clustered round their turrets. The Andarte's guns were muzzled by the order not to open fire on the, quote, great liberators of Greece. The Asphalia, sinister headquarters of the Athens CID, was a symbol which had to be destroyed. It was attacked during the night from the entrance to an underground station, which opened onto the pavement a few yards from the building. The first attack was mounted by the young communists of an EPON group, adolescents aged between 13 and 16, carrying submachine guns or brandishing SCOBY preserves, fell to the defenders' volleys. A second wave gained a few more yards. The defenders waved a white flag and negotiations began. At that moment, a British tank and half-track drew up between the two sides, as they had in Philopappou. Through an interpreter, the captain commanding the detachment spoke to the attackers, "You have to let us take these men away. They are our prisoners." On the evening of the 4th of December, perceiving that events had progressed to a stage where no intimidation would be able to contain them, Papandreou resigned, or rather tendered his resignation. The final decision was Churchill's. The ELAS Central Committee was still hoping that the affair could be settled between Greeks, At 4:50 a.m. on the 5th of December, after a long discussion with Eden, Churchill cabled, Prime Minister to General Scobie, Athens. 1. I have given instructions to General Wilson to make sure that all possible forces are left with you and all possible reinforcements are sent to you. 2. You are responsible for maintaining order in Athens and for neutralizing or destroying all EAM-ELAS bands approaching the city. You may make any arrangements you like for the strict control of the streets or for the rounding up of any number of truculent persons. Naturally, ELAS will try to put women and children in the van where shooting may occur. You must be clever about this and avoid mistakes. But do not hesitate to fire at any armed male in Athens who assails the British authority or the Greek authority with which we are working. It would be well, of course, if your command were reinforced by the authority of some Greek government. And Papandreou is being told by Leeper to stop and help. Do not, however, hesitate to act as if you were in a conquered city where a local rebellion is in progress.
Now keep in mind that he's talking about an allied nation and a military fighting force, the ELAS, which was part of the Allied coalition, albeit it was a communist-led organization. But here, quite obviously, Churchill has simply decided to wage war against ELAS in direct violation of the Tehran Agreement. So here, the British Army is being contemplated in use against the partisans. Now, eventually, with the sort of provocation that was in that passage that Niptuck just read you, with the British coming in and rescuing the Greek fascists at the moment of their sort of incipient liquidation, I guess you might say, eventually ELAS did wind up in an open armed confrontation with the British. They fired on the British. The British then responded with full military force and began a wholesale military campaign against the Greek partisans while World War II was on, and this led into a fierce Greek civil war which raged for several years after World War II.
That again from AFA program number 1, looking back from 1984, The Hidden History of the Cold War, Part 1, that was recorded in April, again, of 1984. Now, in Greek Tragedy, Parts 1, 2, and 3, we have taken a look at how the European Monetary Union, and to an extent the European Union itself, are basically realizations of a long-standing German stratagem for dominating not only Europe, but the world as a whole. And we've spoken about Greece and the fact that, although certainly there was mismanagement of the Greek economy by many of their oligarchs and allied political elites, the fact that Greece did not have an independent currency and could not devalue its own currency exacerbated the problem enormously. If Greece was not part of the euro, then they would be in better shape. But later on in the program, we're going to hear about how many German business executives are currently on the run from Greek justice for having basically engaged in various unsavory business practices such as bribery in order to cash in on the Greek situation. In the past, we have spoken about the fact that the Greek bailouts are not actually going to help the Greek people per se, but they are going to reimburse the creditors that have lent money to Greece, in large measure, German banks. And one of the things that is taking place in Greece is an absolutely stunning fire sale of Greek assets. It may be that some listeners think that my analysis of the EMU, despite going back to discussion of Friedrich List and others, they may think that my discussion of the EMU as the realization for a long-standing German plan for European and then world domination is a bit extreme. And I have made the point that you don't need tanks and bombers necessarily to effect the conquest of a country. You can do the same thing with economics, and Clausewitzian economics are front and center as to what has been done to Greece. And for people who may think that my comparison of German capital occupation of Greece in the present to the military and economic and political occupation of Greece by Germany in World War II, people may think that's a little forced. We'll listen to the following. This is from the Daily Telegraph, a British paper of August 18th of 2015. It's by Maureen, M-E-H-R-E-E-N as in Nancy, Kahn, K-H-A-N as in Nancy. Greece sells airports to Germans as Bundestag prepares for Day of Reckoning. It reads in part, the Greek government has rolled back on the promise to halt the fire sales of the country's strategic assets by approving the sale of its airports to a German company. Operating rights to 14 regional airports, including those on popular holiday destinations such as Crete, will now fall under the control of Fraport AG, the operator of Frankfurt Airport. That's spelled F-R-A-P-O-R-T. The 1.23 billion euro deal represents a significant climb down for Alexis Tsipras, who had denounced attempts by the Troika to force various Greek governments to denationalize the country's ports, electricity networks, and airports. But the embattled prime minister has been forced into a number of concessions in return for an 86 billion euro aid package to keep the country in the euro for the next 3 years. The deal comes as Germany's Bundestag prepares to vote on the package on Wednesday. Bidding for the airports was won by the German firm in November, but the process was suspended by Syriza amid claims the tender broke competition rules. Fraport, again the German company that operates the Frankfurt Airport, Fraport will operate the Greek airports for the next 40 years under the license agreement. Former Finance Minister Yanis Varoufakis has attacked the sales for entrenching the country's oligarchic elites and hurting the government's coffers to underpriced sales. In a line-by-line critique of the demands, he dubbed the privatizations as, quote, a major disaster in every conceivable way, from the prices fetched to the rate at which the privatizations that occurred were overturned by the European Competition Commission and the Greek Council of State, unquote. The sale comes as a host of Eurozone parliaments are preparing to ratify the terms of the new rescue package, Greece's third bailout in 5 years. And more about the literal colonization of Greece, this affected through economic and political matters, not by using tanks and airplanes. This is from the Global Justice blog of August 19th of 2015. It's by Nick Dearden, D-E-A-R-D-E-N. Greece is for sale, and everything must go. I've just had sight of the latest privatization plan for Greece. It's been issued by something called the Hellenic Republic Asset Development Fund, the vehicle supervised by the European institutions, which has been tasked with selling off an eye-watering 50 billion euros of Greece's, quote, valuable assets, unquote. By the way, a euro at this point is worth more than a dollar. Continuing. The fund was a real sticking point because the European institutions wanted to move it to Luxembourg where they could keep a better eye on it. Anyway, it's still in Athens, and this document, dated July 30th, details the goodies on sale to international investors who fancy buying up some of the country. We've attached it to this blog to give a flavor of what's up for grabs at the moment. 14 regional airports flying into top tourist hubs have already gone to a German company, but don't panic because stock in Athens Airport is still on the table, as well as Athens Old Airport, which is up for a 99-year lease for redevelopment as a tourism and business center. Holdings in Thessaloniki and Athens Water Companies are both on sale, though public protest has ensured that 50% plus one share remain in state hands. Nonetheless, the sale will mean that market logic will dictate the future of these water and sewage monopolies. Finally, there are pockets of land, including tourist and sports developments throughout Greece. A second document, also attached, details the short-term work program of various government ministers, detailing actions they must take in order to add value to these assets. This includes introducing toll booths on roads, to licensing casino rights, to declaring sites of archaeological interest. The document begs the question as to why government ministers are even needed. It would surely be easier to cut them out of the equation altogether and let the appropriate EU institutions directly administer the country. Why does this matter? First, because it makes no sense at all to sell off valuable assets in the midst of Europe's worst depression in 70 years. Those industries could generate revenues to help the Greek government rebuild the economy. In fact, the vast majority of the funds raised will go back to the creditors in debt repayments and to the recapitalization of Greek banks. So the privatizations aren't to do with helping Greece. The beneficiaries are corporations from around the world, though eyebrows are particularly being raised at the number of European companies, from German airport operators and phone companies to French railways, who are getting their hands on Greece's economy. Not to mention the European investment banks and legal firms who are making a fast buck along the way. The self-interest of European governments enforcing these policies on Greece leaves a particularly unpleasant favor. Most important is the inequality this will entrench in Greek society for decades to come. Of course, the fact that the state currently holds these assets is no guarantee of democracy. Clientelism is rife in Greece, but the answer is transparency and democracy, just as German citizens are currently trying to take back energy companies into collective ownership because they see this as a prerequisite for fair pricing and supporting renewable energy. What won't help is flogging off monopolies to private corporations who have no interest in Greece's people. Workers will be sacked and their conditions made worse, while the elite of Europe profits as a result. Greece's government will have lost the ability to make its society function in the interests of ordinary people. But then, I suspect that that is exactly the point. By the way, in addition to the EMU's genesis as a plan first formulated by Friedrich Liszt in the 19th century for a German-dominated European economic union in order to give Germany control not only of Europe, but ultimately the whole world. Remember that in November of 2011, the Troika, the IMF, the European Central Bank, and the European Commission, acting at Germany's behest, installed the Laos Party, a fascist Greek party, as part of the interim coalition government to administer the austerity program in Greece. The Greek people had no say whatsoever in that arrangement. And again, this was a doctrinaire fascist party that was headed by a Holocaust denier, George Kolatsiferos, and this was installed as part of the Greek provisional government, with the Greek citizenry, the citizens of the cradle of democracy, having no say whatsoever in the arrangement. One of the things to note, too, is that Greece's debt is being deliberately overstated by the failure to follow the international public sector accounting standards. And this not only increases Greece's debt beyond what it is, if Germany itself were measured by the same standard, it would be in worse shape vis-a-vis its debt than Greece. Note also that overstating or overestimating Greece's debt also helps Germany because it keeps the euro artificially weak, and that helps the export-driven German economy. An article in the Forbes magazine of January 22nd of 2015 by Panos, P-A-N-O-S, Mordoukoutas, M-O-U-R-D-O-U-K-O-U-T-A-S, Greece's net debt is 18% of GDP, not 175%. What is Germany's? And this reads as follows, skipping down. The trouble is that Germany has been overestimating Greece's debt by failing to follow the International Public Sector Accounting Standards, or IPSAS, which measure liabilities and assets over time. IPSAS, I-P-S-A-S, standards are similar to those used by leading governments, businesses, banks, and investors at all levels, according to Professor Jacob Sol, S-O-L-L. Quote, in fact, the debt has been calculated to be larger than it actually is or would be if one used IPSAS, writes Sol in a recent New York Times op-ed. The answer is to be found in www.freegreece.info for information about just how much Greek debt is overestimated. If you apply IPSAS to calculate Greek debt, the net debt is 18%, not 175% of GDP. What about Germany's net debt under IPSAS? 46% of GDP, contrasted with Greek's 18%. That means that Greece's debt situation is better than that of Germany's. So why doesn't Germany use IPSAS to calculate the Greek debt? For two reasons, according to Professor Sol. First, they don't apply IPSAS in their own house. Quote, a little known fact is that the Germans also do not use IPSAS and have notably opaque public finance standards, he writes. Second, by steering away from IPSAS, Germany can keep Greece on the leash while conveniently keeping Greek debt off its own books. Quote, one reason might be that the Germans have refused to price the debt fairly or properly report its value, which means in the short run that they extract more austerity from the Greeks than they should, and that they also keep this loan off the budget balance sheets because it would come up as a loss under any legitimate accounting standard, unquote, writes Sol. In our opinion, there is a third reason. Overestimating sovereign debt for southern European countries stirs anxiety in foreign currency markets, depressing the euro and firing up Germany's export engine. So again, in addition to masking and maintaining an opaque quality to its own public expenditures, the failure on Germany's part to apply the IPSAS, again, IPSAS standard to itself and to Greece, not only overestimates Greek debt, which keeps Greece on the leash, it also permits the Germans not to write off the Greek debt as a loss, and also it helps to keep the euro weak, which benefits Germany's export-driven economy. And so again, when you hear about how very badly off Greece is and how terrible the Greeks are, bear in mind that in many ways they are a victim of aggression as rigorous as that conducted by the Blitzkrieg of World War II have ever done through economic and political matters. And Wolfgang Schäuble got advice in the early 1980s as a German and European official from Theodor Weicher, who was a Third Reich expert on cross-border subversion. And we review that in the description for the record 861. German businessmen have been fleeing from Greek justice, or are in the process of laying low, because one of the things that helped to push Greece into the situation it's in has been the execution on its altogether corrupt political slash economic landscape of German businessmen and corporations who have been making liberal use of bribes in order to take advantage of the Greek situation. Note that one of the companies that has been doing that is the Siemens firm. That electronics giant is something of a quartermaster for the BND, German intelligence, and basically Siemens is inextricably linked with the BND, the successor organization to the Weinhardt-Galen Nazi spy outfit. It also, Siemens, that is also inextricably linked with the Bormann Capital Network, about which we speak so often, as are many of the other companies referred to as such as Daimler and Rheinmetall. This is from the Business Insider of August 30th of 2015. It's an Agence France-Presse story by Yannick Pasquet, P-A-S-Q-U-E-T. Dozens of German business execs are trying to escape prosecution for corruption in Greece. Siemens, Daimler, Rheinmetall, the cream of German industry, have been mired in cases of alleged corruption in Greece, the country that Berlin has repeatedly admonished for the parlous state of its economy. No date has yet been set for 19 former executives of German engineering group Siemens to appear in Greek court, but it is expected to be one of the biggest financial trials of the decade. And skipping down. German companies had notoriously engaged in corrupt practices in Greece, but such cases are only occasionally investigated, unquote, the German foreign policy think tank said in a recent report. And so again, note that the slide by Greece into the situation that it's in has had a great deal of help, and the German business executive community has been among the Santa's little helpers, so to speak. Now, in the past, we've spoken about just how badly off Greece is. And for the record, 788, we discussed the fact that Greek physical education teachers in their school system are not obliging the students in their classes to participate because so many of them are malnourished. They get busy and can hurt themselves. If you go to a Greek hospital, you have to bring your own sheets and pillowcases because cleaning staffs have been cut to such a large extent. Only wealthy Greeks now can afford to bury their dead. Something that is symptomatic of what is taking place in Greece and that may harbor something or augur large for the future, not just in Greece but elsewhere, and that is what the ZeroHedge.com blogspot correctly identified as, for all practical purposes, slavery for young Greeks. There is something like 60% unemployment for young Greeks, and the ZeroHedge.com has the following post of January 24th of 2014. Europe's modest proposal to end unemployment, slavery. Having spent weeks talking amongst themselves about the chronic and dangerous rise of youth unemployment in Europe, as we warned here, the Center of Planning and Economic Research in Greece has proposed a controversial measure. As Greek Reporter reports, the measure includes unpaid work for the young and unemployed up to 24 years old, so that companies will have a strong motive to hire young employees. Unpaid work sounds a lot like slavery to us, but it gets better. The report also suggested, quote, exporting young unemployed persons. Well, where are they going to exploit them? To the countries that are turning back all of the refugees from Syria and elsewhere in the Middle East? I don't think so. And this is Labor Day weekend, and as we contemplate the labor market. I think when one sees the sort of social devastation that is being wrought in Greece, and then proposals to alleviate the 60% youth unemployment rate by having young people work without pay, I think that that should set us, when we see basically a throwback to the age of slavery, this should set us to sniffing the air a little bit. And although it might seem like something of a reach to some people, I note that everybody's favorite intelligence officer, Eddie the Friendly Spook, as we have seen so many times in the past, is very close to the milieu of Ron Paul. Ron Paul was Edward Snowden's presidential candidate of choice in 2012. Snowden gave money to the Paul campaign. The top legal advisor to Ron Paul's campaign was Edward Snowden's first attorney and is the attorney for the Snowden family. And we have spoken about the fact that Ron Paul, Rand Paul, and the Snowden milieu are inextricably linked with the neo-Confederate movement. One of Ron Paul's top aides is a guy named Walter Block, who was a fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. And from the Southern Poverty Law Center's Hate Watch of April 26th to 2013, an article by Ryan Lenz, L-E-N-Z as in zebra, Ron Paul's new organization reportedly stacked with extremists. Still another board member of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity is Walter Block, a fellow B-L-O-C-K, a fellow at the Mises Institute, who the Daily Beast said believes the wrong side won the war against Southern secession, unquote, and blames most of America's problems on, quote, the monster Lincoln, unquote. And the StephenKinsella.com blog, that's StephenKinsella, of January 27th of 2013, interview with Walter Block on voluntary slavery. Walter believes voluntary slavery contracts ought to be enforceable in a private law society, and in this, I believe he is in the minority of libertarians. So again, one of the top aides to Edward Snowden, or to Ron Paul, Edward Snowden's political idol, believes in voluntary slavery. And again, I have noted that that is not only the ultimate oxymoron, but the ultimate in collateralized debt obligations. And in a world where basically the economic landscape is being systematically destroyed to a large extent, and I think that what is happening in Greece will in time be done to the U.S., I think the concept of slavery is something to think about, although the notion of voluntary slavery seems ridiculous if one finds oneself, for example, in Greece, and if you are part of that 60% unemployed Greek youth work contingent, well, maybe the idea of being a voluntary slave doesn't seem like such a bad idea, and at least you will have food and shelter, right? Well, perhaps. Of course, if you get subjected to the routine sexual indignities that slaves were subjected to and some of the other forms of imposition, well, that is too bad. The Confederate battle flag has, of course, been very much in the news lately after the Dylann Roof shootings in South Carolina. One of the very few articles I have seen that is thoughtful about slavery and the Confederacy from the standpoint of employment slash work is an article by Frank Hyman in the Richmond Times-Dispatch of August 7th of 2015. We're going to wrap up with this for Labor Day weekend. Hyman, the Confederacy was a con job on whites and still is. I've lived 55 years in the South, and I grew up liking the Confederate flag. I haven't flown one for many decades, but for a reason that might surprise you. I know the South well. We live wherever the Marine Corps stationed my father, Georgia, Virginia, the Carolinas. My favorite uncle wasn't in the military, but he did pack a .45 caliber Thompson submachine gun in his trunk. He was a leader in the Ku Klux Klan. Despite my role models, I was an inept racist as a kid. I got into trouble once in the first grade for calling a classmate the N-word, but he was Hispanic. As I grew and acquired empathy, I learned that for black folks, the flutter of the Confederate flag felt like a poke in the eye with a sharp stick. And for the most prideful flag wavers, clearly that response was exactly the point. I mean, come on, it's a battle flag. But what the flag symbolizes for blacks is enough to take it down. But there's another reason white Southerners shouldn't fly the Confederate flag or sport it on our state-issued license plates, as some do here in North Carolina. The Confederacy and the slavery that spawned it was also one big con job on the Southern white working class, a con job funded by some of the antebellum 1%ers and one that continues today in a similar form. You don't have to be an economist to see that forcing blacks, a third of the South's laborers during the years of the Confederacy, to work without pay, drove down wages for everyone else, and not just in agriculture. A quarter of enslaved blacks work in the construction, manufacturing, and lumbering trades, cutting wages even for skilled white workers. Thanks to the profitability of this no-wage, low-wage combination, a majority of American 1%ers were Southerners in the Confederacy. Slavery made Southern states the richest in the country. The South was richer than any other country except England, but that vast wealth was invisible outside the plantation ballrooms. With low wages and few schools, Southern whites suffered a much lower land ownership rate and a far lower literacy rate than Northern whites. My ancestor, Kama Hyman, and his two sons did own land and fought under that flag. A note from our family history says, someone came for them while they were plowing one day. They put their horses up, and all three went away to the war, and only one son, William, came back alive. Like Canna, C-A-N-N-A, most Southerners didn't own slaves, but they were persuaded to risk their lives and limbs for the rights of just a few to get rich as Croesus from slavery. For their sacrifices and their votes, they earned two things before and after the Civil War. First, a very skinny slice of the immense Southern pie. And second, the thing that made those slim rations palatable then and now, the shallow satisfaction of knowing that blacks had no slice at all. How did the plantation-owning 1%ers mislead so many Southern whites? They managed this con job partly with a propaganda technique that will be familiar to modern Americans. Starting in the 1840s, wealthy Southerners supported more than 30 regional pro-slavery magazines, along with many pamphlets and novels that falsely touted slave ownership as having benefits that would, in today's lingo, trickle down to benefit non-slave-owning whites and even blacks. The flip side of the coin of this propaganda is the mistaken notion that any gain by blacks comes at the expense of the white working class. Today's version of this con job no longer supports slavery but still works in the South and thrives in pro-trickle-down think tanks, magazines, newspapers, talk radio, and TV news shows such as the Cato Foundation, Reason Magazine, Rush Limbaugh, and Fox News. These sources are often underwritten by pro-trickle-down 1%ers like the Koch brothers and Rupert Murdoch. For example, a map of states that didn't expand Medicaid, which would actually be a boon mostly to poor whites, resembles a map of the old Confederacy with a few other poor rural states thrown in. And he also talks about the fact that in the South, the vote went 2-1 for Mitt Romney. So a few thoughts there on slavery and where we are going. This concludes For the Record, program number 861, Greek Tragedy, Part 3, being recorded on September 6th of the year 2015. I'm Dave Emery. Happy Labor Day.